Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Let's go to Hollywood now, where there's always been a question of who gets to tell your story.
I think when we are talking about African-American film history, it is a complex one that oftentimes really looks at a very kind of flat, one-dimensional understanding of storytelling of people and has historically been riddled with stereotypes and pejorative images.
That's Rhea Combs. She's the curator of film and photography at the National Museum of African American History. And this week marks the start of the museum's first ever African American Film Festival. And Combs says the films being shown push back against harmful Hollywood tropes.
There has been a very rich tradition of image makers, Black image makers in particular, who have fought against that tide, have pushed fervently to showcase very complex and complicated stories. So we want to be able to celebrate and recognize the fact that there have been those undertold stories that have been produced and being made for decades.
Many of the films in the festival's lineup are from the 1960s and 70s, an era when activists were starting to recognize the power of film.
You had people speaking out against injustice, and they were picking up a camera. And so it's really exciting that we're able to show work like this one piece called Malcolm X Struggle for Freedom that hasn't been screened in the last 30 to 40 years. And we restored this film that looks at Malcolm X in Paris 3 months before he was assassinated.
The restoration process that Combs mentions there is at the center of the museum's overall mission when it comes to African-American cinema. Cane River, a 1982 film directed by Horace Jenkins, is among those that are being featured after being restored.
I'd like a one-way ticket to Cane River, please.
Cane River? I don't believe I've heard of Cane River.
Well, Natchitoches, I'll give him to drop me off on the way up.
Jenkins was an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, and Cane River was his first feature-length narrative film. Just months after the film premiered in New Orleans, the 42-year-old director died of a heart attack, and Cane River never received distribution.
After my father died, that was it. Flash forward to a couple of years ago, and I found an article in the New York Times about an organization called Indie Collect. And they had found his film, and they were looking to restore it. So I reached out to them, and I said, hey, I'm Sasha Jenkins. Horace is my dad, and I'm a filmmaker, too. What's up? And met with the Indie Collect people, and they've been really amazing. And then, you know, some years later, here we are.
That's Sasha Jenkins, Horace's son, who was only around 10 when his father died. This week, after a years-long restoration process, the film is finally being screened again to the public at the African American Film Festival. Watching the restored film for the first time, Jenkins says it feels distinct, even by today's standards.
The simple way to describe it is a love story. You know, a young man who is of Creole descent falls in love with a African-American woman who is of a darker shade. So it deals with color and class, you know, he being from a privileged family. The legend was his ancestors owned slaves.
Your great-grandmother owned the Melrose Plantation, right?
As the story goes, that's true, but that's about all the story I know.
An African woman who owned slaves.
Oh, no. She owned slaves? No, she didn't own no slaves. She was a slave herself.
What my father was able to illustrate in the film is there are so many nuances in terms of race in America then and now. The conversation amongst Black people about Black people is an important part of the film. And just a gentle sort of love story involving Black people in a way that you've never really seen it before. Particularly during that era, the Blaxploitation era, or coming out of that era, everything was just very aggressive and over the top. And his take on romance was very sensual and sensitive and very loving. And it's unfortunate that it didn't see the light of day when it did. Who knows what it would have meant or how things could have changed or what kind of influence it could have had. But I think people who get to see the film now will have an appreciation for all the things that he was trying to say.
Now, I can't speak for everybody on Cane River, but that's how it was in my family.
Well, what about those people that didn't make it? What about them?
Maria, we treated everybody equally. Everybody.
You know, my mama made me promise I'd never see you again.
What? Well, that's just about the dumbest. As a matter of fact, that's about the dumbest thing I ever heard of. They don't want me to see you because of something that happened 200 years ago.
That's the film's protagonist, Peter, who returns home to fight for his land in Louisiana as he tries to court his love interest, Maria. When I sat down with Sasha, he told me why the film still resonates with viewers in 2018.
Land ownership is an important part of the story. And there was a statistic that someone in the film said that, like, every week, Black folks are losing 1,000 acres of land. And by the year XYZ, Black people won't have anything. And I thought that was a really powerful idea, the sense, this idea of ownership and land ownership and the relationship that cultures have to the land. And as people who are of African and Native descent, having this relationship and rapport with the land and this ownership of the land in this, you know, sort of European system of what it means to own land, well, we're here, so if we're going to participate, we might as well be owners as well. That was an important sort of subplot in the story that when you mix that in with feminism, colorism, class, there's a lot there.
Did you learn anything about your dad that you didn't know or didn't have a sense of through this film?
Well, you know, my parents split when I was young, and he moved on to another relationship. The woman that he was in a relationship with before he died, she's from the region, and she, you know, worked on the film and had a hand in sort of cluing him into the world and why it's interesting and important. But inside of the romance in the film, I had a sense of what it might have been like for my parents, you know, what that courtship might have been like, because it was, there's something very, I don't want to say simple, but something so tender about the way the characters interact that it's very genuine. You can't really, you can't make that up. It would be super corny. You know, I mean, someone said recently who saw the film that it has a very 80s vibe.
What does that mean?
Well,
I was a kid in the 80s, so what does that mean?
Well, if you're a kid from the 80s, you will love the appearance of designer jeans. Everyone's rocking designer jeans. Everyone's butt, male and female, looks great. There's a photo mat, you know. I don't know, for those who are old enough to remember.
You mean the days we used to have to take film
right,
and actually get it developed, right?
At a little hut that was usually stationed in a parking lot. There was a photo mat. You know, so the pacing, you know, there's an 80s pacing, maybe. Like, if you watch 60 Minutes from 1975, it's like, it's really hard. You know, it's really slow, the pacing. Everything's so quick now. But I think the pacing of the film is in the spirit of the story he wanted to tell. He was a documentary filmmaker. So there are long scenes. Music is a very important part of the film. And it was funny, the editor was telling a story of how my father would make everyone listen to the soundtrack, and he made me listen to it too. That's the one thing that I always remembered. But in some instances, the music plays out in a way that it's almost like a music video, which to me, like almost like a long form music video, which in an interesting way was kind of ahead of its time, or sort of merging with the emergence of music videos. And I learned from someone that he was inspired by Superfly, for instance, that had like a amazing soundtrack, and he wanted the soundtrack to almost be a character in the film, and that's definitely the way it is.
Do you think that when you look at Black film today in 2018, do you think that there is enough nuance of Black everyday life in those films, similar to the way that your dad was able to bring that to life? Because I think that is one of the most compelling things that you're talking about, is just how nuanced and how delicate these portrayals were. Do you see that filmmakers are getting better at that?
Well, I think Hollywood is recognizing that there's money in this audience, and people of color have more than one way to be. And there's nothing wrong with not having a broad worldview, but Hollywood television in particular likes to put people in boxes. Why? Marketing, money. Okay, this very specific group of Black people like these hair care products so you can sell stuff to people. I get it, but I think this sort of box, that same, literal, you know, pun intended, Black box that we've often been put in, it's too small. It doesn't fit anymore. And you look at, you know, my man Childish Gambino, you know, you look at this sort of new wave of, okay, here are some other Black people too who have stories to tell who are great. And so I have hope that things are changing, but, you know, change never comes as quickly as you'd like.
You're also a filmmaker. Are there any projects that you're working on coming up?
Working on a four-part film about the Wu-Tang Clan. It's their 25th anniversary this year. And to really understand Wu-Tang Clan, I mean, you can listen to their music and enjoy it. It sounds great. But like, to really peel back the lyrics is to have a real understanding of who they are and where they come from. And as I tell people all the time, to understand hip-hop or blues or jazz, you know, all of these art forms are a reflection of and a reaction to the environment. And so to tell the Wu-Tang story, you've got to understand the environment, all the things that they went through to become who they are. And so to me, the music is the cherry on top. It's all the other stuff, the environment, the social climate, all the things that they had to overcome that really make their story compelling.
Is there anything that you're taking away from your dad's filmmaking process and incorporating it into the work that you do?
Well, saying something. Every time I have the opportunity to make a film, I say something. You know, I did a film called Fresh Dressed about the history of hip-hop fashion, and you learn about Sunday Best, and most people, you say Sunday Best, and they think it means wear a nice suit, but they don't realize it means that in certain states, it was mandated that they had to buy their slaves a nice outfit so they can go to church and worship a God that's white, or supposedly white. There aren't a lot of people who look like me who have the opportunity to say things. And so I like to entertain people, but I think it's also important to say something. So every film I do, and my father would definitely feel very strongly about that.
Sasha Jenkins is a writer and filmmaker. Sasha, thank you.
Thanks for having me.